2007, many people have been celebrating Cinco de Mayo Day, and certainly have on the Senate side, so Mr. Britton and Mr. Westman have to endure onions today.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, there are two sets of things in front of you. The first is another set of follow-up to questions that you all have asked earlier this week, and there probably will be another one of these, I'm guessing, after today's hearing. The other is an audit that was conducted by the Secretary of State. It was released May 22, 2006, on Medicaid in-home care payments, and Mr. Taves or someone else from the department will be talking about that with you today. The last thing is to point out that we're trying to wrap things up with the seniors and people with disabilities budget presentation this afternoon, over the next hour or so. And with that, I will turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The Senate was late getting out today, so we have some laters that have not arrived yet. Thank you, Senator Winters, for being here on time. I've been a little bit in trouble. I appreciate you very much for that. As Mr. Britton said, today we are trying to do the wrap-up on House Bill 5031. And with that, I'd like to invite Mr. Taves and company up for the finality of your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Carter, members of the committee. James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disabilities Program. What we would like to do today is finish the section of the book starting on page 54, which is direct financial support in addition to a lot of direct services that the long-term care part of the department provides. We also do direct financial support for a series of individuals, so we want to cover that. We'll then cover program support and central administration fairly quickly. Then I'll talk about the audit, and we'd like to finish then just going back through again the proposed legislation that went with the governor's budget, which we assume at some point will land in this committee, that are packages that are associated with our budget packages and critical to their implementation.
And members, we're on page 57, James, right?
Correct. Did I misspeak? Okay. Yes. Page 57. And then hopefully leave plenty of time for any other issues or questions that you might have. So with me I have Deanna Hartwig, who heads up our Office of Federal Resources and Financial Eligibility, and she'll walk us through the direct financial support.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Deanna Hartwig. The material that I'm going to cover, as James indicated, will begin on page 57. I'll describe the financial services that we provide for low-income, aged, and disabled individuals. Our Oregon Supplemental Income Program provides a small cash grant, $1.70 a month, to aged and disabled individuals who are also receiving federal supplemental security income payments through the Social Security Administration.
May I please ask you to put the microphone closer? Thank you.
Individuals who are eligible for the state supplement are also eligible for the Oregon Health Plan Plus medical package funded through Medicaid. Although our supplemental payment is low, it is required by federal law that we make this payment as part of our maintenance of effort, and we make this in order for individuals to qualify for the federal supplemental security income payment. We also offer an employed persons with disabilities program. This is another Medicaid state plan financial eligibility option. It was designed to enable individuals who are disabled, who were willing to work, wanted to work, to remain employed and not lose their health plan benefits and other long-term services that they might be eligible for. We have special cash payments for individuals to hopefully avoid having to provide more extensive long-term care payments. Some of the things that we provide are one-time payments to perhaps do modifications to their home so they can become more independent, more mobile, and also have a safe and healthy environment to live in. We may also provide cash assistance for the extra costs associated with a service animal. Some individuals have seeing eye or hearing dogs that assist them, so we help with that. We are also required by federal law to provide payments for Medicare beneficiaries who meet certain income guidelines. For example, the qualified Medicare beneficiaries. That's a fairly mandated program. We pay the Medicare Part B premium, the coinsurance, and annual deductibles for Medicare services for the Medicare individuals who have income at the federal poverty level. For the special low-income Medicare beneficiaries, those are individuals with income up to 135% of the federal poverty level, we only cover the Medicare Part B payment. The food stamp program, which
is clarification, Mr. Britt.
Just a question. On the Medicare buy-in, the Quimby and the Slimby benefits, those are in DMAP?
Correct.
Okay. So those members are in the office, or in the Oregon Health Plan, actually non-OHP part of this, of the DHS budget.
The food stamp program is a federally regulated and funded program. However, for individuals who are aged or disabled, our local state offices and our area agency and agency partners determine eligibility for the seniors and people with disabilities. We provide direct financial supports to about 69,000 individuals every month. We do have one key performance measure. It is related to individuals with developmental disabilities who have
Do we conduct random audits on food stamp programs? Who does?
The children, adults, and families provide those. I believe our staff are involved in those. We are part of those quality reviews that are conducted on a regular basis to make sure that the state is in compliance with timeliness and accuracy.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, children, adults, and families, they've had a team that's been working for years now on, as you probably recall, we had some pretty high error rates in the state and faced federal penalties at multiple times. And actually, I can't tell you off the top of my head what the error rate has come down to, but it's come way down. And I think on our field side, on the senior and disability field, they perform very well in bringing those error rates down. So, but the leadership of that is out of the children, adults, and families part of the department.
Thank you.
The performance measure associated with direct financial support programs is for people with developmental disabilities with the goal of employment who are employed. This measure tracks our progress in assisting individuals with developmental disabilities who wish to be employed to find and maintain employment. It also contributes to our goal of people living as independently as possible. As you can see on the chart on page 61, we have met this goal since 2002.
If you want to stretch a favor, you do have a lovely voice. Can I ask you to come up a little closer?
It sounds so loud to me, but apparently it's only in my head. To compare how we are doing with employment services, we use data from our employed persons with disabilities program and compare that to about 23 other states who also offer that program. When you compare our program to others, we rank about fourth in terms of highest average annual earnings for people in the employed persons with disabilities program. We rank in the top 10 in terms of enrollment per capita. We also have a program where we place people 65 and older in senior community services and employment programs. In terms of some of our achievements the past biennium, in 2006, we received a continuing five-year renewal of our Medicaid home and community-based waivers serving aged and physically disabled individuals. As Mary Lee Fay mentioned earlier, we also had a review by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid of our two developmental disabilities waivers, one for comprehensive services and one for support services. We fared quite well in that review as well and do not anticipate any problems with future renewal of those programs. We also help transition about 70,000 dual Medicare, Medicaid individuals from the Medicaid prescription drug benefit to the Medicare prescription drug benefit. That took the effort of virtually all parts of our department and the very able assistance of community partners, including the Area Agency on Agencies and other organizations.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, if you could, review the document that we received today in the question packet. It's document 3 on EPD. And go, if you wouldn't mind, just quickly, primarily I don't understand the different types of services that the numbers are associated with in the middle of the page there.
Oh, okay. Which one are you asking?
I'm sorry. It's so in the packet we received today, document number
yes.
3 is a review of the employed people with disabilities statistics for May. Is this all general fund funding, EPD, the dollars you spend?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, individuals who are eligible for the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program are also eligible for Medicaid. So their health benefits are covered through the Oregon Health Plan Plus Benefit Package, which is funded by Medicaid. If they are receiving any long-term care supports from us, either through Seniors and People with Disabilities or our DD services, and meet the service eligibility criteria, their services are funded with Medicaid for that as well.
Follow up on the numerous quickly. So the general fund that we see on page 62 is the general fund match for example, if they're receiving on their, if they're on the health plan, this is the match. Or
actually, Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, that $7.3 million is the general fund associated with the Oregon Supplemental Income Program and the Special Needs Program.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Or there's a break? Yeah. Thanks. Another question.
No.
Mr. President.
Perhaps you may have already gone over this, but I think it's important to point out that OSIP is required. I mean, this is a, you know, it's general fund and it's about $7.3 million. Most all of this is OSIP. But it is a required piece in order for people to get their SSI payments. Is that right?
That's correct.
Thank you. Okay, then we'll move.
Further questions? Your first question is?
Oh, Madam Chair, I interrupted there the discussion on document 3. I didn't mean to, sorry. So I guess my question, thank you, is just, could you explain the center there where it talks about the participants based on the different types of services?
Are you still on document 3?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, the Employed Persons with Disability Program is open to individuals with physical disabilities, developmental disabilities, and also for individuals who might have a mental health disability that meets the Social Security impairment criteria. What we were hoping to illustrate with this chart is our total numbers of individuals in the program, which is 614. I know there's been a particular interest in individuals with developmental disabilities and our efforts to help them be employed, have high earnings, and perhaps have a way to maintain more of their income. The Employed Persons with Disability Program allows them to do that. They still have a cost share client contribution, if you will, but it is calculated off their unearned income only. So they do retain all of their earnings if they are in this particular program.
Could you look at 04 and 05 targets and tell us what happened between 04 and 05 with the deceleration?
Madam Chair, I believe what occurred during that time was more effort on our part to make sure that individuals both in the developmental disabilities community programs, for example, case managers on the county side, personal agents in our support services brokerages, and our eligibility workers in the field were very well aware of this particular option for people being employed and wanting to maintain Medicaid eligibility. The policy staff in my office who do training made sure that this was a focus of the regulatory the trainings that we've provided during the course of the years. We've developed a particular training that focuses just on employed persons with disabilities. As you've heard from some of the advocates yesterday and earlier, they are concerned that people with developmental disabilities in particular are aware of and know of every option that can assist them to earn more money and keep more money. So a large number of the individuals that are coming into the program are from the developmental disability population.
So just my clarification again, please. So when I look at 04, how far you went with your target, but then how you went down from that target in 05, what would you say account for that difference?
Senator Carter, members of the committee, I think part of what happens is what happens with everyone. The employment opportunities begin to shrink. In some of these instances, we tried to refine our data as well so that we make sure we're capturing everyone with a goal of employment who wants to be employed, looking to wage information to help us evaluate our success in that area, looking at other supports that might be receiving through our service providers to assist them. So the information on employment comes from a variety of different sources, and I think efforts at various times bring it up, and perhaps lack of efforts contribute to it falling, and then again just the general conditions of the economy.
Was there anything that the state could have done during this period of time, or did you lack any resources in being able to bring these people, you know, to the equivalent to the year before?
Madam Chair, I guess I would answer, and we sort of covered this the other day. We have not done a very good job, A, of capturing employment and wage data, and as we described the other day, I fear we sort of started talking almost bureaucratic about different population groups who move from different types of services where we have data sets in one and not in the other, but part of the dilemma is we've moved our vocational programs around or moved people to different benefit packages and then not kept up with the data. We have still some major federal grants in the employment area that we are working with vocational rehabilitation and really looking at much more outreach, and I believe part of that is better data collection efforts, but these data sets just aren't what they should be, and I don't know what else much to say about that, although we recognize that we really have to improve that.
But I was trying to find out if it was a lack of fundamental resources from the state as to why the population of people that was at from your target date up to the 56.4%, like right. What happened to those people? Did they lose services? Did they not find jobs? Or you know what the situation was? That's what I was trying to find out.
Yes, it might be more beneficial, Chair Carter, if we had an opportunity to give this a little more look and provide you with better detail as right. to what was driving these factors up and down.
Because I know this committee is very interested in that. If there's anything that we could have done and possibly looked at this more definitively, I can give you this. Thanks. Further questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're going to move on to program support, starting on page 67. I'd like to bring up Kathy Cooper.
Committee, before we go on, we're going to be wrapping this up today, and that's why I'm trying to get all your questions in, look at your performance measures, so that you will have questions answered and when we get started to work the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Kathy Cooper. I am the Deputy for Senior and People with Disabilities within the Department of Human Services. I'd like to briefly take you through our program support and do a little bit of wrap-up on our central administration. First of all, about 15% of our whole budget is focused on program support, but I want to make sure that you understand that a number of the positions that we have in program support really provide direct client services to Oregonians. A couple of examples that will help you understand that are our direct service staff that are part of our Disability Determination Services Program, which is 100% federal funded through Social Security Administration.
They take eligibility determinations under Title II and Title 16 of the Social Security Act for individuals that claim that they no longer can work because of a disability. Today we have about 190 staff across the state that do disability determinations for Oregonians for Social Security Administration. I do want to note that just yesterday our Disability Determination Services Office was notified by Social Security Administration for the second year in a row, which is unprecedented, that they will receive the Commissioner's Citation of the Year for exemplary performance in accuracy, timeliness, and productivity in providing exceptional service to disabled citizens of Oregon. It truly is the highest honor that Social Security Administration bestows on disability determination offices across the nation.
Well, let's have you stop for a minute and give you kudos and give our office workers kudos for their work and
absolutely
for receiving a national award.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I will pass and convey your thanks to them. Thank you. Another group of direct service staff we have is under the Oregon Revised Statute 410. It allows our area agencies on aging to choose not only to do the Older Americans Act services and Oregon Project Independence, but they also have the ability to choose whether to do Medicaid services for seniors and people with disabilities. In Oregon, we have a number of different options, and in Oregon, where a AAA, an area agency on aging, chooses not to provide the service, we have state employees, which are senior and people with disability employees that do direct services in offices around the state. We have approximately 675 staff that are state staff that provide services under the Medicaid program, and we have approximately 750 of those that are contracted to our local governments through our AAA or our area agencies on aging to manage those offices. The other major part of our program support is the four offices within our central administration. You have, over the last 2 weeks, had the opportunity to meet our four administrators. The Office of Developmental Disability Services, Mary Lee Fay, over the last week has given you a very good overview of our developmental disability services. Her area has responsibility for both children and adults with developmental disabilities primarily. Their office is responsible for the operation and the running of our state-operated group homes, our Eastern Oregon Training Center. They administer all of the contracts with our local government and our providers of developmental disability services. They have responsibility for the implementation of the STALEY agreement that you've heard about and for all the program and policy development in that area. The second office we have is the Office of Senior and Disability Programs. Jeanette Burkett led the two-week presentation talking to you about the responsibilities her office has around program and policy development for Oregon Project Independence, for Older Americans Act, for our in-home programs under our home and community-based waiver, which includes our home care worker program, as well as our independent choices waiver. She also has responsibility through her office to manage all of our field offices statewide for senior and people with disabilities. Our third office, you just met Deanna Hartwig, the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, as you heard, has responsibility for all of our Medicaid waivers and eligibility for both Medicaid, medical, long-term care, and for food stamps for targeted populations. She also has responsibility for determinations of individuals that have disabilities that may be able to get an enhanced level of medical care in Oregon, which we know as the Oregon Health Plan Plus, and also has responsibility for a lot of our rate setting data and performance information for our organization. And our last office is the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care. Mary Gere is the administrator, and she did a presentation last week allowing time to talk to you about all of the licensing and regulatory and quality oversight we have for all of our nursing facility and community-based settings throughout the state. Her area includes not only the licensing and the regulatory, but the policy and rule development and standards for services within all of those community-based and nursing facilities in Oregon. Her staff are part of the client care monitoring organization that has offices around the state that ensures the compliance and standards around quality of care for all Oregonians. The area that they also have responsibility for is adult protective services for corrective action and for field review of our offices statewide. The next area I want to spend just...
Madam Chair.
Senator Marshall.
Before we leave this area, I want to go back to the chart on page 68. And you were talking about staffing levels, and the state staff is 676. The area aging staff is 750. At some point, I don't even know if it has to be part of this process, I would like to have the savings that the state accrues on the different levels of staffing, the equity issue. I want to know how much money you save by having the area on aging contract to do the same services that are provided by the state staff people. And that would include benefits, it would include pay and the whole bit. That's not something I need immediately, but I think as long as we're on that topic, I'd like that for further reference. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that actually there's a chart in this book, and I'll pull it out before we're done and circle, because we have a pretty precise number that outlines that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The last area I want to spend a few minutes on is quality and efficiency improvements. The department, and particularly senior people with disabilities, have been active participants in a DHS staffing study that you probably have heard quite a bit about over the last several years. It was a result of a budget note during the 03-05 legislative session, and it put some major expectations on the department to spend time studying some critical pieces around efficiency and around process improvements in several areas. And they asked us to review and spend time in our classifications looking at staffing, standards, our organizational structures, our service delivery methods, our supervisory and support service structure, and the application of technology where it would help efficiencies. To that end, SPD has been using the recommendations both from a public-private executive steering committee as well as a contractor, Public Knowledge, who has come before this assembly on a number of occasions over the last couple of years, indicating ways that the department could develop and improve its methodology to better measure workload as well as caseloads, and to improve the standards by which we are able to measure the work that is performed. Currently, the staffing methods that are before the assembly have been based on a caseload, but during the last 2 years, we have reviewed the work that our staff do on a daily basis, and we have adopted those new staffing study recommendations, and there's a copy before you. And with that change from a caseload to a workload standard, we believe that workload better captures and reflects a lot of the non-caseload work that happens every day in our field offices on behalf of clients. It captures and the transactions of workload, and it sets forth a clear, measurable process to adjust staffing, to review allocations on a more timely, periodic intervals, and it allows it to be better understand by many of us as well as you. They are clearly more measurable than caseload standards have been in the past. And clearly from a public knowledge perspective, they're flexible to allow when new work is identified or when changes happen because of management actions, efficiencies, or changes in caseload, we can measure those and adjust caseload and staffing as a result of it. So to that end, SPD is proposing that we move forward on the workload standards that have been under review for the last number of years as a future for our staffing model and for future legislative action. It will address the critical staffing needs that, as you can see in the document, would indicate by a workload standard that our field is understaffed by approximately 200 staff. And it would be vital to help us fulfill the mission we have to keep people independent, safe, and healthy. So to that end, we believe that you heard last week through public testimony, I believe Mr. Donenfeld addressed this issue, that we really have not been able to keep up with the work in our offices because of the old caseload standards, and the workload standards would better reflect the actual work that is going on and needs to be done.
Madam Chair.
We also have moved forward.
Just one moment. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. I love this chart, by the way. Did your policy option packages reflect the workload or the caseload? Maybe you were getting to that, but thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carter, Representative Kotek. The study has just been completed by public knowledge, and it was not done in time for us to be able to get it into the governor's recommended budget or into a policy option package. We're bringing it before you today, and we have a lot more detail we'd be glad to provide you that would drill down into the detail of this, and then we hope that we can bring it forward at other legislative opportunities in the very near future. The other piece of the DHS staffing study that I thought was also important to bring some attention to was around the whole workload improvement and finding efficiencies in the work we do. We all recognize that we can't just continue to increase staff without also trying to improve the work. And to that end, seniors and people with disabilities have been working over the last year on a simplification of the tool we use to do the assessment for people into our long-term care services. We have a prototype that we are sharing with our field right now, and we hope to have that implemented within the next 6 months in all of our field offices. We also are looking at tools and training to improve our adult protective services. In the recommendations we had from public knowledge, they asked us to look at some existing tools and to see if we could move to a better way to both record our investigations and our reports that come out of that, really to help us not only document but to improve our timeliness. We are in the process right now of going through a request for a proposal, and we believe that we have a couple of very good viable possibilities, and we will be able to move on that over the next biennium.
Just a quick question before I forget.
Thank you.
In regards to your timeliness comments and recording, are you using that SpeakRight program in, you know what I'm talking about?
Senator Carter, Representative Boone, I appreciate the question very much. I believe in the rebalance session, our sister organization, Children, Adults, and Families, had received permission and some funding to move forward on SpeakRight. We have been doing an evaluation in senior people with disabilities, and actually I have a proposal on my desk as we speak to do a pilot pilot. We would like to move forward in a pilot, especially with our case managers that spend most of their time in the field, as well as our adult protective services staff, because as we've asked them, because of the complexity and difficulty of their work, many times they complete the initial visits, they do the work to make sure the client is safe and healthy, but they don't come back and get the paperwork done, and those reports don't get finished and recorded. And we believe SpeakRight will give us that opportunity and that leverage that they really can do it, talk into the phone as they complete their work, and by the time they get to their desk the next morning, they'll be able to have that information already recorded. We really see it as an advantage, and we appreciate you asking us the question. Thank you.
Question? Yes. A little bit back to your staffing trends in comparison. When you did your studies, was included in those studies time on task as a part of?
Yes. Senator Carter, Senator Winters, yes, it was on task. It looked at all aspects of the work that our staff did, and I would be glad to give you the detailed information on that.
Follow-up. I would appreciate the detail. And when I say time on task, you know, outlining one task may take 5 minutes, but another task may take 10, and some other case may take 20 or 2 hours.
Senator Carter, Senator Winters, the public knowledge entity that was contracted by the department actually shadowed our staff and actually did task analysis of each and every day of their work. They did analysis in each of our classifications to determine the time it took in each element, and then did extrapolations of all that information across our whole system. So we do have a minute-by-minute record.
Thank you.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me just for a minute, Senator. Mm-hmm. Are there questions I've missed about the name?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, just hold on for a minute.
Senator Gorley.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce some phenomenal young women who've just arrived. They are with an organization called Girls Incorporated. And the director of the program is here, Annette Kleinfelter. These are our future leaders. Madam Chair, and I'd like to ask if we could invite a number of the young women up to join us on the panel so that they can have that experience, so they have time while they're in the room.
So can we do that quickly? I have 9 seats.
And Kathy, the rest of work right now is a two-minute presentation.
We're in the midst of a committee, and I didn't think we can do that, but we certainly can have them join us here at the...
And Madam Chair,
Senator Gorley,
if we could give them 2 minutes, I think this is a great part of their learning experience.
I do understand,
Madam
Senator.
Chair.
We just don't have the time. I'd like to have them join us, but the time is just really fleeting.
The other thing I would like to do, just very quickly, is acknowledge Gloria Fluker. Gloria, I've known for about 3 decades, and she's someone who has worked for many, many, many years with young people in our community. That's her heart, that's her passion, and it's a pleasure to see you here this afternoon.
You're right.
Okay.
I want to thank you very much to the young women who are joining us today for being this is your legislature. If we can find some time once we finish our presentation here, we have some time, we'd love to entertain that idea. But I want to make sure that we finish because we'd like to not go over this piece again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and take it into the next week.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carter. With that, I think I will wrap up my comments. I will provide more detailed information to you in writing on our efficiencies. With that, the last small piece I want to describe is our central administration.
Okay, let's hear from Representative Nathanson before you go further.
I apologize.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. Since you raised the issue, and thanks to members of the committee who brought this up, the Speak Right for increasing efficiency, I think it's wonderful when I hear continuous improvement ideas and ideas that save money or increase efficiency or improve service and outcomes for the citizens. And in some cases, in one project, you get all three kinds of outcomes. Those are terrific. So what I'm wondering now is, since other agencies or departments or offices are doing this also, are there economic efficiencies that you are able to achieve by partnering with other people who are already doing this, for example, in bulk purchasing or group training and so forth, so that it costs even less or the opportunity for cross-training improves and so forth?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, I appreciate that question. The reason we are looking at Speak Right truly is to gain efficiency and productivity. As I indicated, the CAF organization has already started doing this. They have invited our SPD staff in the pilot to join them in the trainings that will be happening over the next month or two. And we are working with the vendor right now to see if we can gain some cost breaks because of the number of staff that we would have using it across our organization. So we're trying to address all of those. Thank you.
Just a brief follow-up. This is great news to hear. I'm so glad to see those times when what seems to be walls between different bureaucracies are torn down and we can have people working together to improve things for everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wrapping up on central administration, it is the smallest part of our budget, which is probably the best part of the good news. But I did want to just reflect on one piece of it. One of the pieces we do in our central administration is offer support to a number of boards and commissions. Seniors and people with disabilities really value the vital role that our stakeholders, our consumers, and other members of the public play in our organization to really help us in our rural development, in our program and policy development, and really in the implementation of our service delivery. And so to that end, our central administration supports the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We support the Oregon Disabilities Commission, the Oregon Deaf and Hard of Hearing Advisory Committee, People with Physical Disabilities Advisory Committee to the Department, the Oregon Developmental Disability Council, as well as the Home Care Commission. And again, each of those groups that we staff really do play a vital role to make sure when we go forward with policy and rule, they really are reflective both of the needs and the wants and the desires of our consumers and our stakeholders, as well as meet our policy requirements with our federal partners. So with that, unless you have further questions, I will turn it over to Mr. Taves to do our final wrap-up.
Further questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, if you turn to page 73, I just want to quickly highlight again the legislation that was introduced by the governor at the department's request. The first is House Bill 2178. We're still working with the industry and the chair of this committee and the co-chairs on where we're going to land on the nursing facility provider tax. Those bills still sit in the revenue side, but obviously the funding for whatever we end up with here has to match what ultimately comes out of the revenue committee. So we're still hard at work on that. House Bill 2194 was addressed by a bill that Senator Morissette introduced, Senate Bill 42, which updated our statutes to allow people in foster care to remain there for periods of time unsupervised if they were really safe and it could be documented in their plan of care that was something that could be done safely. there was a past practice that the Attorney General felt we didn't have authority to do under statute. So that's already been addressed and signed by the governor. Senate Bill 157, I think, sits with the co-chairs now. It's I talked quite a bit about this during the budget package presentation on the Home Care Commission, and it updates clearly the statutory authority of the Home Care Commission, that it is truly independent in its policy making, but the department will provide the staffing, budget, and accounting support for the commission. So we're hoping that committee will, that bill will come to this committee. Senate Bill 158, and there's a corresponding bill that I think just passed the House, House Bill 3033, I believe it is, deals with workers' compensation for home care workers, and part of the issue we're attempting to address there is that even though home care workers are clients, are employees of the clients, under workers' compensation law, early return to work is always limited only to the place of employment where the injury occurred, and in many cases it's not appropriate for that person to return back to the home of the client. So under this legislation, the Home Care Commission can elect coverage on behalf of all the workers, or on behalf of the clients for all the workers, and then we can actually offer early return to work opportunities in different homes rather than just the home where the original injury occurred, if for example light duty or something like that can be accomplished in a different client's home. So we're hoping that that will be resolved in one of the two bills. And finally, we discussed at length the other day Senate Bill 164, although the bill coming to this committee or to the Joint Ways and Means Committee will actually be Senate Bill 328, and it incorporates many of the provisions in Senate Bill 164, and that would incorporate the developmental disabilities youth population into the juvenile PSRD program. So,
Senator Marsat.
The Home Alone Bill, House Bill 2194, I think we're still working on that. There seems to be a glitch in the administrative rule interpretation, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I think the home loan issue itself has been resolved in Senate Bill 42. The other issue we're still working with on amendments to that bill that's in your committee that would address some individual previously that were served in other people's homes under the home care program where we were required to license it as foster care, and we wanted to grandfather people in so they wouldn't lose their home care benefits. I believe that's the bill you're referring to.
I think there's another issue, but we can deal with
it. Okay, certainly.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that House Bill, I think it's 2406 and 2407, Representative Kelsey's bills are not in the governor's budget, but would you comment on the policy perspective on those bills? I mean, I know we have to deal with the budgetary issues, but has the department reviewed them and have any... We pursued waivers and other things in the past. I'm just wondering the perspective of the department.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, yes, and we did a lot of consultation with Representative Gelser in the introduction of those bills. The 2406, is that the waiver? It's the Family Opportunity Act. The discussion on that still has been, if Healthy Kids in some form passes, then House Bill 2406 would really be more of a wraparound that would allow families to enroll, not go through a two-month period of uninsurance and a few other things of that sort. So it's still sort of is tied to the fate of Healthy Kids. If Healthy Kids does not pass, then I don't have the latest fiscal on that. I think we're working on that or have that if it was to be a standalone program. No state has yet adopted the Family Opportunity Act. I don't even think the federal regulations are out yet. So I think most states are thinking it's a good idea, but it's still sort of a work in progress. The other bill, House Bill 2407, the waiver, and you saw some very compelling testimony from families yesterday. The waivers we have for kids are really for kids with extreme disabilities, technology dependent, ventilator dependent, or with real extreme autism and behavior issues. Other kids that have significant medical problems but not a profile that high, their families literally have to impoverish themselves to avail themselves of in-home services or place their kids out of the home, and that's clearly why we have 60 or 70 kids in nursing homes. We, even if additional funding to add new caseload isn't forthcoming, we still are intent, and we've actually had a consultant helping us write what that waiver would look like if we could at least move kids out of nursing homes or help families where there otherwise would be an admission to a nursing home where we would be spending those dollars anyway, so that we could actually do it in a neutral budget fashion, but at least begin to open that door. So I think with or without funding, we're still hoping we can move a new waiver request. If Representative Gelser's bill passed, then it would fund an additional waiting list group to be added to that. But either way, we think it's a good policy direction.
Thank you for that.
Further questions? Mr. Tate?
Madam Chair, the last issue I want to address you have in front of you is that we're required to
have this sheet before you.
Madam Chair, in 2006 we had a Secretary of State audit on our Medicaid in-home program, and they looked at several areas of the state and several of our organizations to see if we're running the Medicaid in-home program according to federal and state policy. They found a number of issues. I would say percentage-wise, it wasn't a large number of cases, but clearly some cases that had been authorized outside of policy. They sampled over 1,200 live-in cases, for example. They found live-in providers, in some cases, that had full outside employment, which didn't truly mean they were full-time live-in providers, as they were being compensated by the state. They found clients where the service hour calculations on their in-home plan did not reflect the evaluation that had actually been done on the client. They found cases where payments had been continued even though service had actually changed or the person no longer received and was receiving in-home services. They found vouchers with wrong service dates, not updated with signatures, authorized hours that were incorrect. So a variety of cases, and again, we serve almost 12,000 people in the in-home program, so it's a very large program. We have done some extensive work since that time. We went to all of our field offices, took every single case, worked through each case, and if it was in fact wrongly coded or unauthorized hours were being received or the living provider was actually still in outside employment, we cleaned up those cases, resolved each one of them individually. Then we did a series of rule changes to clarify the rules, policy transmittals. We've added this activity to our field review team, which goes on about a 2 or 3 year cycle through all the offices in the state, pulls a large sample of cases to see if the accuracy is really there. So I think we've resolved or are well on our way to resolving most of these issues. We also, I described a little bit several days ago in the in-home program, again, which is a very robust program compared to most states, and we take a great amount of pride in it. But it's a very decentralized and type of program that does not lend itself always to a lot of easy monitoring from the central office. So we have to look at different strategies to make sure that cases are accurate and clients are getting the right services. One of the things we're doing, we have convened a work group. It's actually going to start next week with labor, with our stakeholders and others, to further look at our in-home rules. We are really going to drill down also on the employer-employee nature of the relationship for in-home programs, because I think through our field and through cases that we've sampled, we found people that really, either because of cognitive issues or dementia or other things, truly don't understand and don't have the capacity to make that hiring decision, even though the case is set up as a client-employee-provider program. And that just creates all kinds of problems and potential for abuse. So we're working on that, and I think we're making every effort to strengthen this program, but not to erode its capacity to support lots of our clients in their own homes.
Question? Representative
Williams? Yeah, just a quick question. In a case like you just outlined, where someone may not be able to make their own hiring decisions for whatever reason, do they use a patient advocate or proxy vote or whatever, some guardian, I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, an excellent question. We've tried to, and how this will look by the time we're done, I can't tell you exactly, but we obviously have ideas. We want to sort of separate clients for those who clearly have all the skills. They can make the hiring and firing decision. They can direct their own care, and everybody can sign off on that. Then a sort of secondary group where they have family members available to help them do that, so that we can at least assure that the person may not have all the skills, but they have sufficient help. Thirdly, the Home Care Commission itself is looking at training strategies that would actually help train clients if they have the capacity to learn those skills, so that would be another category. But then finally, we will have some clients in the in-home program now for whom none of those conditions can be met, and I believe that's an appropriate case where we refer the person to an in-home agency, so they no longer employ their own home care worker, but then we have an in-home agency that actually sends someone in and is responsible for the hiring and firing decision and the directing of work. And I think that will move things forward in a positive way. But we do, I mean, we have sat with our case managers and people from our field who actually detail cases where they're really, and it's a bigger problem because the Oregon Constitution Ballot Measure 99, which set up this program, says the home care program is one in which the client makes the hiring decision, and the state pays the cost of that care. Well, if cases end up in court or arbitration or anything else, and it's pretty clear that there was not a hiring decision, then really I think Bowie or someone else could say, well, the state really was the employer, or the Area Agency on Aging was really the employer here, because you made the hiring decision, you directed the work. So it's something that really needs to be addressed, and I think we're confident that we'll do that and do it fairly quickly.
Thank you. Mr. Tate, the random, when the audit was conducted, I'm assuming that it was done randomly, the cases rather than. In the final, was there any particular field office that stood out?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, there's always a few field offices that perhaps stand out a little bit more than others. But I think, you know, we focused on those. Both me and my staff have gone individually into some offices and worked very hard, and I think our local offices are making great strides. So I wouldn't want to single anybody out, but obviously there are some offices that over time have been a little bit more outside of policy than other offices.
Because sometimes that can also follow up, can also denote whether added training or some other measures need to be taken
correct,
inside
correct.
Of that field office. Also, along that line, I noted that there wasn't any, with I think one or two recoveries. Is there any plan where you find that in the instance where the individual was actually working and wasn't taking care, is there a recovery plan or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think we've looked at those case by case and referred for overpayment or recovery where we can, and in other cases where it clearly would penalize the client, or it occurred because our staff or our offices actually set up the case wrong. You know, we never attempt to go back and penalize the client unless we absolutely have to. But I think we have worked through those cases and referred some for overpayment and not others. I can't give you the exact breakdown of that. we could probably get that.
Just a comment, given the volume, action the percentage is relatively low.
What was your point, Cindy?
Well, the point is, normally with a volume like this, you're going to find probably a much higher error rate.
Okay.
And I'm just giving kudos to the agency, because actually if you really look at the number of cases that they looked at, that they sampled, and you look at the actual findings, that with 29 vouchers with questionable service dates out of 1,240, and I calculated rather quickly the dollar amount, and you're talking about $600,000 at the high end.
Then my question was, what are your plans for the future in terms of some level of oversight, or do you go in and inspect more often?
Madam Chair, we set up 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we redeployed some existing staff and set up a field review team. We sent them, the first part of their mission was to go out and just do training and technical assistance. So we went virtually to every office in the state and said, this is not a gotcha kind of exercise. This is really to help you identify where you have difficulties with policy issues and to do the training and technical assistance. So that was the first round. We're now into round number two, where when we go in, after that we require a plan of correction. We still offer technical assistance whenever possible. Ultimately, if we can't correct, you know, we have authority under our statute and contract to actually sort of do overpayments with some local offices or the field as well. But our goal always, again, is... And I think the neat thing about Oregon's system is virtually every case is set up electronically. So our staff, even in the central office, can go behind every case, look at the narrative, look at how it was set up. So we don't even have to always go out into the field to check on things. And actually, before we do field visits, we will pull up a whole sample of cases and look at them, just if we can spot trends at the get-go before we even go to a local office and start pulling a lot more cases. And I think the Secretary of State, we've had multiple meetings with them, and I think they've been pretty supportive of that kind of approach.
Good job. Further questions?
Madam Chair, that really is the end of our presentation, unless there are issues or questions.
Senator Marsat?
You were going to show me some data on the page somewhere.
Madam Chair, I highlighted it, and I'll pull this out and bring it right up to you the second we're done here.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Taves, I want to congratulate you on running a department with the level of efficiencies that we've been hearing about today, and with the way you have reported to us in this committee. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. We've enjoyed being here.
Come in. Before we leave, then I'd like to if you'd like to stay and see our young people in action.
We would.
Okay. So can I have the director come up here and take your seats where you are? Excuse me just for a moment. I'd like to close, I got to take care of business. I'd like to close the hearing on House Bill 1531. Next week,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a reminder, next week this committee will be hearing about the department-wide support services, which is the administrative branch of the Department of Human Services.
Ms. Kleinfelter, why don't you join us at the podium here, and whatever way you're gonna direct the girls, just come up here and speak.
Okay, the girls actually really second in some way. Thank you all for making the time to hear from Oregon's and future leaders. We hope that they will be taking their seats at some point. So girls, come up front. They're going to be facing you and doing a collective presentation for you. Thank you. And while we know that what's happening today is not focused on drug and alcohol prevention funding specifically,
We are part of a national organization where there are 150,000 girls meeting in their state capitals across the country and all advocating for funding that will prevent drug and alcohol abuse. And so girls have stories to that that are specifically focused on that area. So, okay, very good.
Hi, my name is Sydney, and I'm a girls and girl. Have you known anyone in your life who's been touched by alcohol or drugs?
I do.
Hi, my name is Tanya Taylor. I'm a girls inc and I'm 14 years old.
Hi, my name is Michelle Duel, and I'm a girls inc and I'm 14 years old.
My name is Chloe Ward, and I'm on a girls inc and I'm 14 years old.
Hi. Hi, my name is Pamela White. I'm a girl
and I'm 14 years old.
Hi, my name is Shane Sweet. I'm a girl
and I'm 13
years old.
Hi, my name is Leanne Cattell. I'm a girl and I'm 13 years old.
Hi, my name is Taylor Ross. I'm a girl and I'm 13 years old.
How old?
12.
Okay.
When I grow up, I want my husband to be divorced. When I grow up, I want to get divorced. When I grow up, I don't want to live with what I need to my divorce. When I grow up, I want to live with what I need. When I grow up, I want to be pregnant at the age of 15. When I grow up, I want to yell at children. When I grow up, I want to lie all the time. When I grow up, I want my husband to be abusive. When I grow up, I want my husband to be abusive. When I grow up, I have to get divorced. When I grow up, I don't want to get divorced. When I grow up, I want to get divorced.
When I grow up, I want to get pregnant at the age of 15.
When I grow up, I want to yell at children.
When I grow up, I want to lie all the time.
Of course, we know that all of these girls want to grow up and with strong, smart, and bold futures. And we, of course, appeal to those of you who are the decision makers in our state to give them the opportunities and the skills and the resources to make strong, smart, and bold decisions so that they don't grow up to those lives that are devastated by drugs and alcohol, but rather achieve all of the infinite possibility and potential that they possess. So we thank you for your hard work, and we thank you for your courage.
Can I ask you a question, Ms.? So, yeah, thank you. Ms. Kleinfelter, thank you. So how do we stop the messaging that they have now?
Well, we give them opportunities like Girls Incorporated. We give them opportunities to come to Salem and to use their voice and to use their power. We did present a proposal to you that would provide 1,000 girls with a program called Friendly Persuasion. That is the only research-based drug and alcohol prevention program for girls in the country. All of these girls participate in that program. And 750 girls in the metro area. I myself grew up in Brookings, Oregon, a very rural community where girls don't have access to opportunities and programs like Girls Incorporated. And many of them have grown up to be impacted by domestic violence and early pregnancy, and they're stuck in a cycle of poverty because of it. And so, yes, we want to have opportunities and funding so that we can continue to do the work that we know that has positive impacts in the lives of girls. We want you to support the efforts that we know are important to enrich the lives of young people so that they can see their possibility and have the tools to achieve it.
Thank you, guys. It does take courage to do this. So I appreciate you very, very much. Representative Boone.
Well, I'd like to offer a piece of unsolicited advice. And it doesn't matter where I grew up in Portland, and now I live at the coast. And it doesn't matter where you grow up. One of the things that you should definitely do is stay in school and get all the education you can. And it doesn't mean you stop when you graduate, because then you can go back to school at any time and just continue your education, because the more you have, the better your opportunities will be. And I think it's corroborated by actual evidence. So.
Yes, yeah. That is all of our girls' school.
And it's fun. Madam Chair.
Senator Quigley?
During our hearing, Senator Winters and I leaned over to each other and we looked to our left and we looked to our right. into your beautiful faces, and what we said to each other is that we're looking at our replacements.
That's great.
You're saving us out there.
How many of you guys live in North Portland? That's right.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that I know in one of our earlier presentations, probably in the addiction mental health budget presentation, and it might have been Senator Morissette, he talked about the fact that we have seen an increase in alcohol use among young girls. And if the resources are available, I think we should look at dedicating some funding to that population, especially if we have evidence-based programs available to fund.
Madam Chair, I heard Brent Summers from Northeast Portland. I grew up in Portland and I grew up in Northeast. And I live Northeast. And I can only echo, I think it takes courage to come here and stand before us to share your message with us. And I would like to second the good representative Kotek that if any way we can possibly make an investment in young women. You know, we hear so much about the needs of young men, and I'm glad that you're here to tell us about the needs of young women. And also, I hope that others are listening, that you've persuaded us in a very friendly way.
Thank you very much.
You're awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you for the committee, and the committee is just
good girls.
You're welcome, Gracia.